handful of homes in the old part of town, which is right by the runway, with water up to or above the roof line.
More people evacuate as the Yukon River flooding in Galena gets worse. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, May 28th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Anchorage students go without summer school for the first time in at least a decade.
It makes a huge difference for kiddos who need the extra support, so it's very frustrating that it's been pulled back instead of extended.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Complete a bachelor program without leaving home. Whether a first time or a transfer student, the University of Alaska Southeast has the degree for you. Visit ketch.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
More than half of Galena's 400 residents have evacuated as flooding from an ice jam on the Yukon River worsened today. Power has been shut off as a precaution. There is no city water available. Jeremy Zedek with the State Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management says a dike that protects the airport has been breached, but the runway is still usable. At least two helicopters have been sent to the community. He says no injuries have been reported. Ed Plum is a hydrologist with the National Weather Service. Plum has been in Galena for the past few days, taking frequent flights to check the condition of the ice jam at Bishop Rock. He says the river level has fluctuated as the ice moves and compacts.
This afternoon, the water came up to its highest level so far. So the water at this level, there are a handful of homes in the old part of town, which is right by the runway, with water up to or above the roof line. And in the new part of town, just upriver from the airport, there are also homes with water that deep. And a lot of the homes here in Galena are up on pilings, you know, 4, 5, 6 feet or more on pilings. So a lot of the homes just had water under them. But then when we had this third surge of water, even the higher homes, a lot of them started to get water in them. And the concern was that some of these homes may get lifted off their pilings or foundation and, you know, start floating. And that did happen. There were a few homes that we saw from the air and from the road here at the airport that have lifted off their foundation and are kind of tilted in the water.
Ed, you said earlier, you used words like catastrophic and devastating when we spoke earlier. Describe what the scene looks like there for us.
It has been catastrophic and devastating for people in the community just because some houses are filled up, you know, to the roofline or higher and lifted off their foundations. The other thing is it got into a dangerous situation, especially this afternoon when we had this third surge of water and ice and water started rushing into town, and it was flowing quickly through the trees and there was ice coming down some of the sloughs, and people were at that point deciding to evacuate their home by boat. And there's a couple homes, one in particular, they tried to evacuate. And from the air, we tried to give them an area where they could escape through the back of their house, through the woods into some low-lying areas. And it's all flooded all around Galena. It's just all the swamps and the forests are covered with water. And so, but apparently they tried to get out and the current is just too strong. And so they had to turn back, and then their boat's tied up to a tree behind their house, and the family's in the boat. And there's another family that was in the boat tied up to their house with the two kids and their dogs, just sort of waiting out the water for the current to diminish so they could get to a safer area.
I understand that there's some at least state help there now, possibly federal help. Who's arrived?
Governor Parnell just arrived about an hour ago, and so we briefed him on the ice conditions, and the community's been briefing him on the situation with the evacuations and where there may be people that are still stranded at their homes in the flooded areas. And also there's the C-130 arrived, and a Black Hawk helicopter just arrived too.
Are there other rivers that are also experiencing flooding in the area?
Yeah, so with this hot weather that we've been having, we do have flood warnings out for the Kobuk, for the village of Kobuk on the Kobuk River, the Buckland on the Buckland River, Hughes on the Koyukuk River, and we also have a warning out for Koyukuk, just downriver from Galena, because this jam is going to break at some point, and there will be a slug of water moving downriver. So at some point, the water will come up dramatically downriver from Galena.
Ed Plum is a hydrologist with the National Weather Service. Normally, students in the Anchorage School District would be starting summer school in the next week or two, but funding cuts have canceled the program for the first time in recent memory. The cuts will impact struggling students the most, especially immigrant, refugee, and other students learning English. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has the story.
During one of the last days of school, a group of second graders dropped carrot seeds into neat rows in the raised beds of the garden at Airport Heights Elementary School.
Good job, guys.
Hey, yay!
Usually, kids who need extra instruction can continue at Airport Heights through summer school. Second grade teacher Marcy Jasper, who's leading the gardening, says she's frustrated that the program was canceled.
It makes a huge difference for kiddos who need the extra support, and I've wanted them to extend the program, so it's very frustrating that it's been pulled back instead of extended.
District-wide, more than 6,000 students will do without summer school this year. Mike Webb, the principal at Airport Heights, says canceling summer school will undoubtedly hurt students, especially young kids who are learning English. He says they usually forget stuff over the summer, and if they're not speaking English while school's out, it's worse. He's afraid it could really set kids learning English behind, and that can add up.
If they're not getting it in second and third grade, then by the time they get to fifth and sixth grade, we're still trying to teach them what should have been done 2 or 3 years ago. So we're swimming upstream, so to speak, when that happens.
Nobody could say exactly how many years summer school has been an option, but administrators agree that it's been around in one form or another for more than a decade. Anticipating budget cuts, the Anchorage School Board defunded the $2.8 million program for grades K through 12 last year. Superintendent Ed Graff says the district made a tough choice.
We've struggled with, you know, how you allocate resources. Do you spend those resources during the regular school year, or do you take from that allocation for the regular school year and hold that until the summer months? And I think we felt we needed to, with the declining revenue that we had, use those resources to support the kids during the school year.
But parents like Maribel Reyna, who immigrated to the United States from Mexico, are worried their kids will lose their English over the summer. Reyna has three kids at Airport Heights, a kindergartner, a second grader, and a third grader. The family doesn't speak English at home. She says summer school has been critical for her two older children, who attended for 5 years. Now they speak English fluently, she says, and are thriving in middle school.
Porque ha sido un gran soporte para mis niños.
I'm concerned about my younger kids not attending summer school because I've seen the huge improvement that they've made during the previous years when the others attended, and I like the fact that they don't get disconnected from the school.
Reyna says she plans to enroll her kids in a free church program over the summer, hoping that they'll get to practice English there. At Airport Heights, students speak around a dozen different languages, and about a third of students are learning English as a second language. Test scores have been low at this school, but they're slowly improving. Educators worry that without summer school, though, those gains could be lost. Maya-Lisa Pratt has been an English language teacher for the district for more than a decade. Private summer programs, she says, are often costly and out of reach for most of the families she serves.
My families are Title I families. They can't afford to pay for something. So a lot of the camps you could go to, campfire, things like that, that have enrichment programs that they could go into, they don't have funding to be able to afford it, or they don't have cars to get them there.
Pratt notes that free church and community programs do not have the academic focus of summer school, and she doesn't think they can actually take up the slack left by the district. Second grade teacher Marcy Jasper says she's bracing for the impact.
This will be my first year where I know those kids aren't getting the extra support, so I guess I'm going to see the loss of English over the summer. So I guess next fall I can have more to say on that.
In addition, teachers and administrators at Airport Heights say they're nervous about more possible cuts to programs that support English language learners in August, just before school starts. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, city kids get a taste of life in a remote village.
Most of the biggest kids were really grossed out. Even so, we tried the raw spelt eggs.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Those living with asthma know that each day their life can take several different routes. So take care of yourself with daily medication and you'll be well rested and eager to take on the day. Miss taking your medication and you'll end up with restless sleep, days at home sick, or even in the emergency room. So treat your asthma even when you're feeling your best to keep you from your worst. Information at asthmainalaska.org or 1-800-LUNG-USA. This message sponsored by the American Lung Association.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reports type 2 diabetes rates across the nation tripled between 1990 and 2010, and rates among Native Americans are more than twice, almost three times, those of Caucasians. But demonstration projects for American Indians and Alaska Natives show there are ways to prevent or delay onset of the disease. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes has more.
Several tribal health organizations in Alaska have received Indian Health Service grants to run diabetes prevention programs for pre-diabetic people. The program calls for 16 weeks of classes and regular coaching toward weight loss and increased physical activity, as well as lab work and exams to track progress. Kelly Keyes Zeifel of Nome is program coordinator for the Norton Sound Health Corporation's diabetes prevention program. She says staff there had been worried about whether they could get people to stay the course.
At first, we were concerned that 16 weeks to be involved would be a really long time, and it is for a lot of people. But we found that people really get committed to the program and enjoy the program.
The risk of developing diabetes increases with the number of conditions people have. Conditions such as high blood pressure, high blood sugar levels, a waist size of more than 35 inches for women and 40 inches for men, and abnormal cholesterol levels. Risk increases with age. 95% of new cases show up among people age 44 and up. Waleen Whitson is site coordinator and lead instructor for the Lifestyle Program at the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium, or SEARCH, in Sitka. She says genetics are also a factor.
I think the big thing about the public is they think that it is inevitable that they're just going to get it. Because my mom had it, my grandma had it, my uncle has it, I'm just going to get it. And they don't realize that there is prevention, that they can take a lot of steps to prevent or delay it.
A person is considered pre-diabetic, at high risk of developing diabetes, when a fasting blood test shows high sugar levels. Whitson says a recent analysis showed the 200-some pre-diabetic participants in their program lost an average of 24 pounds and 3 inches in waist size.
In year one, it kind of, the numbers went the wrong way. In year two, we even back out, and then three, four, and five, bam, exactly what we want to see.
Nome and Kenai programs report similar success. None of the pre-diabetic participants in the Kenaitse Indian Tribe's diabetes prevention program went on to develop diabetes. Helena Van Veen is a health educator, recruiter, and lifestyle coach for the SEARCH program. She says strong relationships were key to their success. She says they contact each participant at least once a month, and they focus on the positive.
When you got a person in here who weighs who's over 100 pounds overweight, the last thing they want to hear, you need to lose 100 pounds. So we asked them to lose 7%, and we said we don't expect you to do that in these 16 weeks. What we would love for you to do is just to be open and share ideas and share your success stories, and we share ours, and that we know that lifestyle changes take time.
Van Veen says they incorporate cultural traditions by sharing recipes for traditional foods and by teaching food gathering, preparation, and preservation. For example, they have a class coming up on how to dry seaweed. These Alaska programs are a few of the 160 projects nationwide funded through the Indian Health Service's Special Diabetes Program for Indians, or SPDI, which was launched in 2006. University of Colorado Professor Spiro Manson is co-author of a recent evaluation of SPDI projects that shows participants significantly reduced their risk of developing diabetes. Manson used programs in one region of the country as an example of how costly it can be to treat diabetes and its complications.
We saw that approximately 10.8% of the patient population treated in that in a given calendar year at that large service unit was responsible for consuming nearly 37% of the total healthcare expenditures.
Under the budget cuts known as sequestration, the Special Diabetes Program for Indians has been cut 2% for 2013. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
A group of friends in Anchorage is hosting a series of bone marrow registry drives for a local doctor who was diagnosed with an aggressive form of leukemia in March. Matt Dudley is a family practice doctor who cares for patients at Anchorage hospitals. Jocelyn Pemberton is a colleague of Dudley's and is helping organize the drives. She says it was a shock when Dudley was diagnosed.
He's mid-30s. He's very athletic, you know, healthy guy. Two young kids, young family, and, you know, just out of nowhere gets this diagnosis.
Dudley needs a bone marrow transplant. He has two brothers who were tested but aren't viable matches. So Pemberton is hoping to convince Anchorage residents to sign up to be bone marrow donors. People between the ages of 18 and 44 can register by filling out a questionnaire and offering a few cheek swab samples. Most of the time, the bone marrow donor doesn't have to go through surgery to donate. Pemberton says many people she talks to about the drives are already organ donors, but bone marrow donation is different.
Bone marrow is something you can give while you're alive. And I think people are kind of scared about it because everybody has always heard of the surgical process. But the reality is that, you know, it's a pretty simple thing that you can do to save someone's life.
Dudley is hoping to find a match in time to have a bone marrow transplant in June or July. The first bone marrow donation drive is at both the downtown and Diamond Skinny Raven locations this Wednesday and Thursday from 3 to 7 p.m. The events are timed to coincide with bib pickup for the Skinny Raven Twilight Runs. Several other drives are scheduled through June. Check our website, alaskapublic.org, for information.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. As an active senior, your independence is important to you. One of the ways for you to maintain your independence is to reduce your risk of falling. A fall risk assessment can be part of your initial or annual Medicare exam. They'll ask about your vision and review your medications for possible problems. Learn ways to improve balance, strengthen muscles, and reduce hazards at home. Contact your Medicare provider for an appointment. This message in good health is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Are wood bison and plains bison two different subspecies, or are they the same subspecies? That's a question that is raising some questions of its own, now that a University of Alaska Fairbanks researcher has co-authored a paper that could affect the threatened designation of Alaska's wood bison. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports.
Dr. Matthew Cronin is a research professor of animal genetics at UAF. Cronin and his collaborators say DNA analysis does not support the designation of wood bison and plains bison as different subspecies.
The evidence for them being different enough to be designated subspecies, in my opinion, just isn't there, either with genetics or the historical mixing of the herds.
Cronin, who is based at UAF's Agricultural Research Farm in Palmer, found that plains bison and wood bison are genetically similar and even found that some plains bison are more genetically different from each other than they are from wood bison. He says that decades ago, plains bison were introduced to the Canadian wood bison herds.
The wood bison and plains bison were designated back sometime in the 1800s or 1900s. But what's in the literature abundantly is that 6,700 plains bison were put into the herd of 2,000 wood bison in Canada in the late 1920s. So they were mixed. So, you know, we really can't assess the original condition of the two groups.
Cronin, who published his paper in the May edition of the Journal of Heredity, studied both plains and wood bison in five states and in two Canadian provinces. Cronin admits that scientists often squabble over what designates a subspecies.
The scientific community has debated the whole subspecies category, and many, if not most, population geneticists like myself recognize the entire category has been used very subjectively. In other words, people have designated a subspecies without a lot of rigorous scientific evidence. And that's been going on since the late 1800s. And so there's a lot of subspecies for which there hasn't been adequate analysis.
Wood bison are currently listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act, which allows the listing of subspecies. U.S. Fish and Wildlife spokesperson Kathy Rezebeck says Fish and Wildlife contends the two groups of bison are separate.
And we based our finding on the scientific information available, which indicated that there's been historical physical separation in their ranges, as well as behavioral and physical differences and genetic differences.
Rezebeck says that the animals were downlisted from the endangered designation to threatened about 2 years ago, and the final ruling on their status was made a year ago. Cronin says the plains bison and wood bison should be considered geographic populations, not subspecies. A special breeding program at the Alaska Wildlife Conservation Center in Portage has brought a herd there up to 200 animals from the 53 wood bison imported from Canada in 2003. Currently, Fish and Wildlife is working with the state on releasing some of those animals to habitat in other areas of the state. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
While we've been airing our series on culture in Alaska, students across the state have also been taking a crash course in cultural awareness. Part of the Alaska Humanities Forum Rose Urban Rural Exchange program is to explore the idea of culture. Students interview culture bearers in their own communities and write about themselves as culture bearers. Then they take turns hosting their sister schools in their home community and traveling to a new place. Eric Brainerd and Amber Fries Newsom from Begich Middle School in Anchorage have more about their group's experience as cultural ambassadors.
Before this program, we thought of culture as something you were born with, your ethnicity or your religion.
Through the exercises, we learn that is only part of a person's culture. We live and create our culture every day. By the time we got to the closing circle at the end of our time in Chivac, we understood a lot more about our own cultures and the cultures in Chivac.
And I'm Joey from Begich, and one thing that I learned is that culture is part of everyday life, and you don't really have to look for it in a village. It just comes to you when you're living the people's lives.
I'm Jordan from Anchorage, and one thing that I learned was that the people in Chivac are really used to changing cultures a lot. Like, at the dances, there were Eskimo dances, but when the teenagers switched to a normal dance, they went to doing dubstep, so they're really used to just changing cultures when they need to.
Hi, I'm Chrissy from Begich, and during this last week, I learned that before you judge a culture, you have to learn about it and experience it and live it.
When we arrived, we were welcomed by the whole school and community.
Hi, I'm Taylor. I'm a cultural ambassador for the Rose Urban Rural Exchange Program. Thank you for welcoming us.
Hi, I'm Alyssa. I'm a cultural ambassador for the Rose Urban Rural Exchange Program. Thank you for having us.
Little kids wouldn't ask if we wanted to play. They just start playing. We felt kind of like celebrities. We spent 6 days there, going to classes and learning dances during their Cultural Heritage Week.
We went ice fishing out there. It's called Manaki. There's no reel. You pull the line in by hand. Sometimes you use bait, and sometimes you snag the fish with a hook called a snagger.
This is a snagger hook, man-made hook.
I found another one.
It's not like other hooks. We have to snag the stick up so that the hooks could go into the fish's body.
It was fun to watch how comfortable the Chivat kids were with fish guts and cutting up fish in general. Most of the Bigage kids were really grossed out. Even so, we tried the raw smelt eggs.
Try, come on, Jordan.
What did you just eat, Joey?
Raw eggs.
It was slimy, chewy, an interesting kind of way to be good.
We spent a lot of time listening and learning from the elders. Every morning there was an elder talk.
Teach us about the group of stars. Which side of that community, which side of the...
Some of the Chivat kids were really into their traditional culture, learning the dances, and some of them even speak fluent Chupik. We noticed that when the elders were speaking to the kids at the school, they seemed more interested and more engaged.
Points out that one star in the northern side, that one star never moved. Even Chupik people that had never been in a classroom knew that. We had astrologers, and we had medicine men.
Being part of the exchange seemed to help Chivat kids realize what they have.
Hi, this is June. One thing I learned is that it's always great to be thankful for what you have, especially for your culture.
Hi, this is Molly. One thing I learned that you could still try learn how to speak Chupik in many ways. In each class, you just have to practice.
Hi, I'm Christian from Chivat, and when you move away and you're still a part of that culture and it sticks with you no matter what.
Since the trip, we've changed too. We noticed how much more respectful people were in Chivat, and it's helped us remember to be more respectful here. We think more about what we really need and what we throw away. It's also helped us to see that we don't always need to be as loud.
Every one of us Bigage students were impressed by how easy it was to make friends in Chivat. How mostly, kids there are a lot like us.
We all feel like we've made more lifelong friends. I'm Eric Brainerd.
And I'm Amber Fries Newsom.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton, Ellen Lockyer, and Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, and students Eric Brainerd and Amber Fries Newsom, also in Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
Complete a bachelor program without leaving home. Whether a first-time or a transfer student, the University of Alaska Southeast has the degree for you. Visit ketch.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Don't wait to make your home more energy smart. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation's Home Energy Rebate Program will reimburse you for energy efficiency improvements. And if you don't have the upfront cash to make the investment, financing is available through Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Start saving money and energy today. Sign up at akrebate.com or call 877-257-3228. This message sponsored by AHFC.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.